Thanks for joining us on a Friday morning edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We missed you guys. We are talking the Nets-Cavs game. The Nets get their biggest win of the season, 102-86 over the floundering Cleveland Cavaliers, moved to 2-2 on the season. We're going to start off with a game recap, talking Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's reintegration into the team. Then some other notes, maybe some stuff on Jared Dudley and Joe Harris, who both had outstanding games shooting the ball. And then segment three, we'll talk about Richard Jefferson's debut as a color analyst. Maybe preview the Nets' upcoming game against the Pelicans, and then we will talk the Houston Rockets and Jimmy Butler potentially happening as a union, and how that's reminiscent of a not-so-great Nets trade that happened in the recent past. All that and more next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, Gavin Shaw, and I am joined by the man who's probably as happy as he will be all season. Josh, this is potentially the last time all year the Nets will be 500 because they're going to win out. They are going to go 80-2, so you will only get sadder because you secretly like it when the Nets lose, and that is my hot take to open this episode.
Wow, that's controversial. Yeah. I'm pretty offended by that.
Yeah, no, I know. I wanted you to be. All right,
you live to offend me.
I do. That's honestly, I take an absurd amount of joy in it. All right, the Nets win 102-86, and I don't know. We can spend a minute or two recapping this game. I briefly mentioned it to you before we started recording, but I think we're both of the mind that more than saying anything exceptionally insightful about Brooklyn, I thought this was just indicative of how terrible the Cavs were. And in fact, with the way the Nets played in the first quarter and a half of this game, I think I wrote down in my notes that it really just felt kind of like a G League game. And it was like 36, 35, 20 minutes in. I think against almost any other team in the league, the Nets would have been down by like 15. And instead, Cleveland just sucked just as much. They missed like 12 layups between the two of them. And eventually the Nets just pulled away in the second half and Cleveland just continued to be incompetent.
Yeah, were you surprised that the Nets offense didn't look that crisp at all? I mean, they got going, obviously, in the third quarter when they just couldn't miss from three. But as you mentioned in the first half, a lot of missed layups, a lot of sloppy ball movement, miscommunication, just a bit of stagnation. And I feel like against Cleveland, where there's not a ton of resistance, Kevin Love's a weak defender, George Hill isn't what he once was, Hood's a disaster on defense, you'd think that they'd be able to get whatever they want. And that's the opposite of what we usually see when the Nets come out guns a-blazing in the first quarter, like they did against the Pistons and Knicks, and then gradually the offense stutters to a halt, and that wasn't what happened in Cleveland, which I'm a little bit surprised about.
Well, here's the thing. I thought they were, I mean, they weren't, there were definitely sequences and stretches where they didn't look exceptionally crisp, but I thought their offense was running pretty well. Like, they were getting all these good looks. They literally missed, like, six or seven open shots around the basket in the first half, and it was, like, the guards, it was the bigs, it was everyone. They just couldn't convert around the hoop, and really the reason like it wasn't worse than it was, and I know a lot of them came in the second half too, but Joe Harris and Jared Dudley combined to go 8-for-10 on three, and a couple of them were just pivotal shots in the first half, and if those guys didn't show up the way they did, this could have been maybe a little iffier. But I don't know, I mean, just the way Cleveland played in the third quarter, the Nets had an 18-1 run at one point. I think it was initially 15-0. I mean, maybe the Nets would have won this game regardless, but it was just an ugly, ugly start.
Yeah, ugly start. Also, Cleveland was pounding them on the offensive boards, ended up with 16 for the game. I think about 10 of those were in the first half. Tristan Thompson was just, I mean, they were throwing up these garbage shots and just getting their own rebounds, so not a ton you can do about it if you're the Nets, but I don't know. You need these types of wins, and I think it's great to see that the Nets didn't have to struggle and have a game come down to the winding seconds against the Cleveland team that's just really bad on all accounts. So the Nets going on the road and getting a comfortable 16-point win where you don't have to sweat the entire fourth quarter, that's been pretty rare over the last few years.
Do you give the Nets any credit for having what at least on paper was a great defensive game? They hold Cleveland to 38% from the field, 17% from three, only give up 16 free throws on the game. And if Cleveland didn't hit 94% of his free throws, this could have been even uglier than it did. Like, to me, it looked like Cleveland missed like quite a few easy shots and just don't have all that much offensive talent. And the offensive talent they do have, like Kyle Korver, is just way past their prime. But I'm interested to hear what you think on that.
Yeah, I think it was, you have to give the Nets some credit because they, listen, they're playing whoever's on the court, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, these guys, they're not the Warriors, but they're still NBA caliber players. And,
barely.
They have Kevin Love, who theoretically is still an all-star talent. Rodney Hood can light it up. Hill can have a decent game every now and then. Chetty Osman's been okay to start the year. So they have a couple guys that can fill it up. Obviously not world beaters by any sense, but the Nets did a pretty good job stopping them. I thought for the most part the energy was there, the activity was there, and especially getting a guy like RHJ back, who played 21 minutes, is a very versatile defender. That's nice to have on the wing to supplement your big men.
I know you're trying to move us forward in the conversation, and I really appreciate that, but I have to really quickly make mention of the fact that I'm just throwing a bone to Ty Lue here. It's probably not a good sign that Chetty Osman, Tristan Thompson, Rodney Hood, Colin Sexton, and Jordan Clarkson all took more shots than Kevin Love. Jordan Clarkson taking 5 more shots than Kevin Love and shooting more free throws. That's wild to me.
Clarkson's a better player than Kevin Love.
That's crazy. That's stupid. I think they're getting.
Well, I think Ty Lue is he the worst coach in the league right now?
No, probably not. But I don't know. I guess I don't know if like anyone. I always like kind of respected like what he did like with like LeBron. Like he was willing to like kowtow to LeBron, but I thought he did it in like the best possible way. And like, and again, like this is the current state of their team is, again, we said it last podcast, such an immense reflection on LeBron. I think this might honestly be the ultimate testament to LeBron being the greatest player of all time. The fact that this essentially the exact same team, I don't think they've added anyone else or changed anyone else other than Sexton, made the finals last year, even in a dilapidated East, is just insane to me. So I don't know if to give Ty Lue credit for that or knock him now that they suck. It's probably more the latter, but I'm kind of confused.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with Ty Lue because, yeah, this roster is horrible. Lost LeBron, obviously. Jeff Green had some heroic games against Boston in the Eastern Conference Finals, but he also never maximizes his talent. I mean, even when they had Kyrie, and those teams were really good and had some solid bench pieces, like Dele, who was decent back then. He's always just like, is kind of just there managing personalities and has no insight as to the game or strategy as a whole.
You know, it's funny because I look back on that 2015-16 finals win, and I don't want to say I think about this a lot because I'm not a total weirdo. I'm just a little bit of a weirdo. But I always find it weird that series, that they needed to come back from 3-1 and like they got just blown out in the first two games. Because I think on paper, you could have made the case that team was more talented than Golden State pre-Durant. I mean, you just, the combination of Kyrie and LeBron, like Golden State just, again, pre-Durant just did not have that kind of firepower. And maybe you give Lue some credit for it, but Curry wasn't quite himself that series, so it seems weird that like they like needed all these heroic performances, and maybe that's a reflection on the coaching. All right, we should definitely move on because this is not Locked On Cavs. It is Locked On Nets. Josh, before I went on that stupid tangent, you brought up Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and he is worth talking about. He made his season debut after he was dealing with, I believe, an ankle injury or maybe a leg injury throughout the summer, and then the birth of his daughter. He was noticeably rusty, 3 of 10 from the field, 0 of 2 from 3, 3-point shot looked as ugly as ever, 8 points, 8 rebounds, but I thought his energy was really welcome and something the Nets missed.
Yep, had a couple, drives where he's usually finishing that, but just shaking off the rust, but great to have him back. What do you think of him going with the short haircut?
It was very disorienting. I was thinking earlier,
I kept confusing him with someone else. I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure who you were thinking of, but it did. And it's funny that you say that because it's not even that made me think of it. When Richard Jefferson specifically was comparing Jared Allen's afro to Artis Gilmore's, I was just thinking about what Allen would look like without the afro, which we saw, I think, if I remember correctly. Didn't he like not have it at a point last year? Or maybe I'm imagining
that.
No, he always had it. Okay, I feel like he would look like a 90-year-old man without the afro. Like if he was, just imagine him completely bald. Maybe there's a middle option there. But I feel like he would look so old without the afro. I don't know. That's a weird take.
I don't know. I think the afro makes him look even older. Just like he's.
It looks
like
retro, like, but.
Yeah, it's like he's the basketball version of Fat Albert being like transported out of the TV from the 70s
yeah.
into game action. I don't know. I feel like he could go. He needs to like raise his presence around the league for a couple of years and then do the Alfred Payton thing where he gets rid of his trademark hair, and then that will become a huge talking point for him.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Just generate some buzz. To me, he's always reminded me of, like, one of the generic, like, original NBA street guys. Just, like, one of the guys who would be on, like, one of, like, you'd have, like, the teams, like, the NBA players, and then you'd have, like, the legendary street ballers. Like, he kind of looks like one of those guys. Anyways, yeah, good hair conversation, and that will be a daily segment going forward. But yeah, Hollis Jefferson, very solid, 8 points, 8 rebounds. My only cause for concern again is that, like, I was hoping, not even whether he made or missed it, because again, he just hasn't played, so I didn't really have high expectations, but I was hoping his form was maybe a little different and a little bit more compact, and it looked really just like awful to me, like, even if anything, like, worse than it was last season when he shot threes and just not natural at all. So Maybe he's refined it behind the scenes and we just didn't get to see it because this was such a short appearance from him. But that to me, again, is kind of the swing skill for him. And if he's not going to make that shot, he's really going to have to make up for it by just being the, like, ultimate, like, energizer guy on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I feel like when your form is so different as Rondé's is, it's just impossible to, like, make it manageable to the point where you have consistency and can really generate enough accuracy when you're shooting threes. I feel like he's, I wouldn't say a lost cause. He can make improvements on the margins, but he's never going to be able to revamp his form at this point in his career to the point where he's a traditional three-point shooter.
Right, because I guess my whole case for it was that he did have, like, really nice touch in the mid-range last year, and I was wondering if that was maybe a possibility. But, I mean, and the good thing about Hollis Jefferson is, like, I think the obvious comp for him is someone like Marcus Smart in terms of the role. I'd like to see him play long term, but, like, unlike Smart, he, like, knows his limitations. Like, he's not jacking. He took 2 threes in 21 minutes. When you see Smart, like, there were playoff games last year where he took, like, 8 or 9 threes, which is just insane. So I do appreciate that about RHJ, and I guess we'll see going forward if that's more of a factor or not. Anyways, this is a 12-minute opening segment, which we strive not to do anymore, so I'll apologize for that, and we'll come back. We'll talk about Shabazz Napier's debut and the rest of the Nets next on, you guessed it, the Locked On Nets podcast. Is your company looking for a new way to reach customers? Your company could be mentioned right now. Podcast listeners are 60% more likely to interact with sponsors they hear on their podcasts. Our demographic is 98% male and more educated and earning more than traditional media audiences. Have your company sponsor this podcast? Email me at gavinshall14@gmail.com. That is gavinshall14@gmail.com. If you're having issues in the bedroom, you should check out BlueChew.com. BlueChew.com brings you the first chewable with the same FDA active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, pre-brunch, post-brunch. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. BlueChew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package. So no in-person doctor's visits, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment absolutely free when you use our promo code LOCKEDON. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, BlueChew.com, promo code capital LOCKED space ON to try it for free. Blue Chew is better, cheaper, and faster. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. Thanks for sticking with us on Locked On Nets. Rondé Hollis Jefferson, not the only debuté, opener, first game guy. We'll go with first game guy. Not the only first game guy. Shabazz Napier making his Nets debut. 2 for 6, 2 for 5 from three, 8 points, 2 steals, only 1 assist. Not a huge impact, but I like the look with him out there with Dinwiddie. Like, I like the idea of having a second ball handler, but one that is way lower maintenance than D'Lo and slightly lower maintenance than LeVert playing off Dinwiddie. I thought he made some nice plays and, like, just kind of as a secondary attacker off of what Dinwiddie was doing. And that three that he hit at the end of the third quarter was to me, like, that was kind of the dagger. Like, I was like, all right, let's pack it up. This fourth isn't going to be very exciting.
Yep, that got me hype. I actually left after the third quarter.
You didn't miss much.
To go to a costume store for Halloween, and then watch sure. I watched the fourth quarter when I got back.
What costume did you get?
I'm gonna be a rabbi.
Oh, interesting. That's very, very on brand for you. All right, sorry. Go ahead.
I'm still deciding whether to be a rabbi or just a doctor.
Mm.
But we're gonna play it by ear.
Okay.
But regardless, going back to Napier, I really like one skill that he has is that he can get his shot off really well at end of shot clock situations. And it didn't always result in him making the basket, but he can at least get a decent look or create separation to get a three-pointer off. And that's one of my big criticisms with D'Lo. I feel like there's times where there's just no chance of him scoring at the end of the clock. And it's such a great skill to have, even to be able to get a shot on rim, get your big guys the opportunity to collect an offensive rebound and regroup. So I think Napier's, I like what I saw. I think he's has potential as a solid third or fourth guard to contribute to this team for not only this year, but maybe next year if they decide to pick up his option.
Yeah, I just think the type of player he is, he's just a very clean fit on this team. And that's obviously something that can occasionally get underrated when grading offseason acquisitions. You just look at the talent. You don't necessarily look at the context. Like, I think just in that sense, and especially at the money he's making, it's a very, very good deal for the Nets. All right, I want to give a quick shout-out to Joe Harris. Again, only four games in. But since a 1-for-7 start against Detroit, he has made 12 of his last 15 three-pointers, which is just excellent. And obviously, probably not sustainable. But his shot, if anything, like looks even a little bit smoother this season. Like every time it comes off his hands, it just looks like it's on a perfect trajectory to the basket.
Yes, he has been awesome. I think it's great to see that after his career year last season, getting that $16 million contract, that he's come out this year and just been even better. So really great to see the improvement and the consistency from Joe Harris. The one, I wish he would go back to his old look, because I feel like the woolly mammoth look, I'm trying to tell my friends, my Knicks fans, like, hey, like, Joe Harris is so good, and they look him up, and like, this guy with the Castaway beard? Like,
yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
It just undermines his credibility.
I agree with you there. How did you feel about Richard Jefferson, like, just repeatedly referring to him as beef jerky guy throughout the broadcast?
Yeah, what was that? Did they overlapped in Cleveland?
Yeah, they did for a season.
Yeah, what? Did he ever say the origins behind that story?
No, it wasn't. It was like a story. It was literally just based on the beard.
Oh, yeah. He looked like...
He just thought he was the Sasquatch. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Jefferson was really going for that bit.
Yeah. And at one point, it was really good because Ian Eagle was just like, are you just going to do this every time? And he's like, yeah, I'm sticking with it. And he's like, Ian Eagle's like, all right, let's go with it. The chemistry between those two was outstanding. And I want to touch on that in the final segment. Jared Dudley also shout out 4-for-5 from three. Again, if he's not shooting well, it feels like outside of maybe a couple good passes here or there, he's not really contributing anything. Got bullied on the boards. And I think maybe we should have touched on this when we were talking about Hollis Jefferson, but we can cover it now. Do you think Dudley starting over Jefferson is permanent just because his shooting makes him a better fit in that starting lineup and Hollis Jefferson's energy off the bench is kind of nice? Or do you think the difference between the two is so stark that fit, regardless of fit, Hollis Jefferson will be in there going forward?
I think it's as currently constituted just because they're so banged up right now. The Nets are with Damari and Kuduts injured, and those are the only two power forwards. I think it makes sense to keep Dudley with the starters and RHJ with the backups.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'd maybe even play Dudley 20 minutes a game and RHJ 28. But once Kuduts and hopefully Carroll can come back, I would move RHJ into the starting lineup because he does deserve it. He was one of the Nets' top players last year, if not their most consistent longest tenured player with the team, as crazy as that is to say, and he's part of the young core. So once Dudley phases out of the rotation, I would make the move to bring RHJ into the starting unit.
All right, I'll throw this out there, and we'll see who's right on it, because I'm going to bank on Carroll playing that starting role and Hollis Jefferson coming off the bench. I think it's possible that I think right now you're absolutely correct, and it's interesting because starting Dudley, I think, is more about Dudley's limitations than Hollis Jefferson's limitations, because, and I think this is, you can let me know if I'm wrong, but I think your reasoning was here that Dudley's only effective as a spot up shooter, and you need that starting talent around him to generate those open looks, while Hollis Jefferson can be more of a primary offensive option coming in with the bench. That being said, I think that same logic still applies with Carroll. Of course, Carroll's game is a little more versatile, and he's a little bit less aged, and he's in better shape than Dudley is, so he'll make more of an impact in other areas. But I kind of like Carroll with a shooter with that starting unit, because you look at that lineup without Hollis Jefferson, and the Nets' like whole philosophy of floor spacing and shooting a lot of threes kind of goes out the window, because I don't think we've seen enough from Russell or LeVert to really indicate either one is an above-average shooter from range. And then you really have Joe Harris as like the only gunner in that lineup if you're starting Hollis Jefferson.
Yeah, fair, but also we have no idea when Damari Carroll's going to come back.
Yeah, that's true. So I'm wondering. Yes, I guess.
Your logic does make sense.
Right. Okay. I'll take that and walk away from it. As far as the rest of the lineup, it's funny. We start off every podcast just decimating D'Angelo Russell every time he has a bad game. And now he plays a fairly good one, 18 points, 8 assists in 27 minutes. I don't even know if I think he barely scored in the second half, maybe just one or two baskets. Still shooting just 5 of 14 from the field, 2 of 7 from 3. Not hyper efficient, but I thought he played a nice game.
Yeah, he played well. Was really good in the first half. I thought some of his passes were on point. He had a good game. I mean, 18 points for him is good. I mean, his efficiency wasn't great, but that's just never the type of player he's going to be. So it was good to see him hit some shots, knock down a couple threes. And I think probably his best all-around game of the year.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. And I think that was a pretty low bar for him to clear at this point. I just feel like I need to see so much more on him to be sold. I was really bullish coming into the season. It was like it was like a week and a half ago. I was saying like 19.7 assists for him. That seems ridiculous now, even in my brain. And I'm hoping that he figures it out and gets something closer to that. But I'm still just based on what I'm seeing. Like he just looks like a smarter version of the player he was last year, and that he's a little bit more under control and he's not forcing some of the same shots he did last season. But just from a skill perspective, I just don't really see a dramatic change from him.
Yeah, it's not even a skill perspective. It's just an athleticism perspective where he just can't create separation. I mean, there's one play in the first quarter where he was got Kevin Love switched onto him. And I mean, we know Kevin Love had this stop against Steph Curry in the finals, but you should be able to, most point guards can take him off the dribble, and he just did all of his fancy dribble moves. It resulted in him going nowhere. He had to pull up for a 20-footer and missed it. I mean, those are the type of plays where that's where your efficiency is really going to rise, if you're able to take those big men when you have a mismatch off the dribble. And if not, it's kind of worthless to get that switch.
Yeah, he just, again, and you're right, it is totally about athletic ability. He just has really dramatic problems with generating high-quality looks. Caris LeVert, far and away, his worst game of the season, one that was honestly like it looks like just a typical stat line from him last season, playing a team high 32 minutes, not that portion of it, but 5 to 12 from the field, 10 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists. He was solid, and maybe if this game was more competitive, he would have made something happen in the fourth quarter. Did have a couple of really nice plays, including just a brilliant feed to Jared Allen for a dunk where he just double pumped his way by defenders and threw like a no look behind his back pass to Allen that I don't think anyone saw coming. And I think Allen barely saw it coming. So I give him some credit for that. And I expect maybe a little more in the coming games from him. I think what we saw the first three games is closer to the player he is than what we saw last night.
Yep. I'm excited to see how he does against New Orleans and the Warriors. Those are two tests, obviously going up against some star level players and really, teams that can fill it up. So the Nets are going to need to make sure their offense is crisp and that they're getting into the high triple digits.
All right, not much else to note from the bench. Shout out to Ed Davis, double-double in just 17 minutes. He continues to be efficient and a strong presence defensively. With that, we will wrap up segment number two. Come back, maybe quickly touch on Nets Pelicans tomorrow and then get into Richard Jefferson's debut as a color analyst for Yes. We'll have that next for you on Locked On Nets. Nets Pelicans, they play, I guess, tonight for everyone listening. Time. It's a weird thing. The Pelicans, undefeated on the season, unless I miss their latest game, I believe they're still undefeated. They've been arguably, I think, right along with Denver and Milwaukee, in my mind, like the most impressive team in the league so far. They are still 3-0. They have a plus 15 scoring margin that was helped by dropping 149 on the Kings. That is the highest scoring margin in the NBA. And I think their style, I know Brooklyn played some good games last year, like that first one. Like I remember, I knew New Orleans blew them out once, and then there was one where the Nets just had a wild comeback and like there's lost an overtime. Yeah. It was double OT. I think it was like 127, 122 or something like that. So I'm interested to see if the Nets can play them that well again. I just think the way the Pelicans are shooting the ball and playing right now, like maybe you could make the case they're due for a little bit of a regression. I would say it's very conducive for them running the Nets off the floor tomorrow.
Yeah, I think obviously two great games last year. It's tough for the Nets to match up with the Pelicans because Anthony Davis is a star, one of the best top five players in this league. He went for 44-17 in one of the Nets games against the Nets last year, and he's really unstoppable. I think the other one They played them twice. One was with Boogie and the other was post-Boogie. Yeah, so Anthony Davis had 33 and 11 in the first game. That was the game Rondo had 25 assists, and the Nets got absolutely embarrassed. So they just really need to figure out a matchup for him. RHJ is too small. Jared Allen's still learning. He doesn't necessarily have the awareness to keep up with him for 35 minutes a game. So I think that's going to be tough. Biggest key will be keeping them out of transition. Watching a guy like Mirotić in the open floor, he's always lurking, knowing when to spot up for threes, and he can knock down four or five in a row if you let him. So they really have to be cognizant of that transition defense. And on the offensive end, I think just attack them. I mean, New Orleans is a good defensive team, but they can be scored upon. So I think just Nets have to reduce turnovers, be crisp in their sets, and they can be competitive in this one.
I think just to punk New Orleans, I think they should start the game with Jared Dudley guarding Davis, just really get in his head and be like, what are they thinking? What is he going to do?
I don't think that can get in Anthony Davis's head.
I don't know. Well, we won't know until they try it. Yeah, I'm generally with you. I don't think we have to say too much more on that. If the Nets play the Pelicans close, even in a loss, like I'm talking under 10 points, like I will be, and like genuinely under 10 points, like that's like the margin of the whole game, not like a BS run at the end to make the score look a little bit more aesthetically pleasing. I will be genuinely impressed with Brooklyn, and that's what I would look out for watching that game. All right, Richard Jefferson, our guy, your guy specifically, probably, I assume, one of your childhood heroes on those great early 2000s Nets teams, had an incredible 17-year career, always seemed like someone very capable of doing media. I thought he was really good considering it was his first game as a color analyst. Like, you have some of those natural bumps and bruises where he was occasionally, like, talking over, like, Ian, and Ian had to interrupt him. But I thought, all in all, he was really good. He was really funny, and there were some genuinely good insights into the game. And I know it's only a part-time role, and Sarah Kustak's going to do the majority of them, but I continue to look forward to what he's going to do going forward.
Yeah, RJ was awesome. I think my favorite part of the broadcast is when Kevin Love came over and hugged him. But he was really good. He's one of my favorite players from growing up. And we've seen throughout the years on road tripping that he's very natural. And Gavin, maybe it'll be the same for you, taking that traditional podcasting to the NBA jump.
Yeah, I just missed my 17-year playing career. But you know what? I'm only 23, and there are guys who entered the...
Still do it, buddy.
I'm like the same age that Joe Harris was when he entered the league. We have approximately the same build. He just has 2 inches and like 100 pounds of muscle on me. But, you know, I think it's in play. I really enjoyed him. And like, I just think like the upside for someone like Jefferson who played that long. And sometimes you have players like, I mean, you see it all the time with guys like Charles Barkley and Shaq who had like these great, incredible careers, and it just doesn't translate. And I don't necessarily think that's due to an inability to think the game at a high level, because they obviously were both capable of that. But you have to be a great communicator. And sometimes guys aren't just naturally all that good at that. Like, they're both like incredibly funny, but I don't know if they're great analysts. Like, I think Jefferson like really thinks the game in a type of way. And more importantly, he knows the level of insight that fans expect right now, and he's willing to get into that stuff. I also thought the video of just like all the Cavs guys just like ripping him apart was pretty good. So I'll say that.
No, that was great. Are there any Hall of Fame players that are good announcers?
Hall of Fame. That's a good question. I'm trying to think.
Who's the best player that's a really good announcer?
Well, Steve Kerr was incredible when he was a color analyst. Yeah, like, he was far and away my favorite.
But RJ's better than him. Had a better career.
Yeah, as a player. Yeah, sure. Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah, he was definitely a better player at his peak. I think better career could be argued just because Kerr got like 4 or 5 rings. But anyways.
Oh, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, let's put it like this. Like, if I could have lived either one's career, I would have rather had Kerr's career than Richard Jefferson's.
I would have rather lived Kerr's career, but Richard Jefferson's more accomplished as a player.
I mean, he was definitely